Adventures of PC 49 by Alan Strax, being another incident in the career of Police Constable Archibald Barclay Willoughby, with Brian Reese, Joy Shelton, Leslie Perrins, and Eric Phillips. This week's adventure, The Case of the Black Diamond.
Changing Moods, the familiar signature tune from one of the most popular series in the history of BBC Radio, The Adventures of PC 49. Of all the detectives we've examined in this series so far, the aristocratic amateur, the professional psychiatrist, the village spinster, and the retired Belgian police chief, the most unlikely is today's subject, the humble Bobby on the beat. Unlikely because the dominant cultural tradition in Britain was, until the 1950s, the stereotype of the lovable, accident-prone, comically incompetent Bobby. It stretched back to Gilbert and Sullivan's chorus of policemen in The Pirates of Penzance, lugubriously singing, "A policeman's lot is not an happy one," and it included the popular music hall sketches of beloved comedians Sandy Powell and Rob Wilton bungling their police duties, and the succession of British comedy stars who've donned the blue uniform to play comic constables. It's a tradition summed up by Charles Penrose's perennially popular record, The Laughing Policeman.
I know a fat old policeman, he's always on our street. A fat and jolly red-faced man, he really is a treat. He's too kind for a policeman, he's never known to frown. And everybody says he is the happiest man in town.
This consistent, lovably comic image was an important means of diffusing discontent. For there was a long-standing suspicion and hatred of the police, the plague of blue locusts as they were known, in some sections of the working class. But another reason why the police were so often comic was that they were themselves working class. And before the 1940s in popular culture, the working classes were almost invariably comic. The amateur sleuths were serious because they were, by and large, gentlemen. And it was they who dominated the crime-fighting scene on film, stage and radio. All this was changed by the advent of PC 49.
And now for the manuscript.
I'm afraid you won't find it there, chum.
What? Constable Barclay Willoughby. What brings you here?
Cripes, 49!
I came to tell you I wouldn't be able to play a duet with you tomorrow night.
I think you're going to find he's a far better policeman than he is a fiddler, Mr. Carousel.
I don't quite understand.
Good law. That's my fiddle you've broken. I know by those white scratches on what used to be the back.
Yes, this afternoon I made the grave mistake of putting my fiddle in your case and yours in mine. And as you see, I have had a regrettable accident.
The same applies to your fiddle, Maestro.
What is this, you say?
It got run over by a car, Mr. Carousel. Matchwood, nothing but matchwood.
No, no, oh, it is irreplaceable. I cannot play on any other instrument.
Don't worry, chum. You won't be playing on any instrument for a very long while.
PC 49 was Archibald Barclay Willoughby. Educated at public school and trained at Hendon Police College, and thus a far cry from the old, slow-witted, slow-talking, "Hello, hello, hello, what's going on here then?" Cockney copper.
49! What the devil do you think you're doing?
Oh, good morning, sir. I'm practising for the police concert. I've almost got it right, sir. Listen.
Constable, stop that hellish din at once!
Hellish, sir? Well, I couldn't find anywhere else to practise, so...
Out you go, 49.
Oh, yes, Sarge. Just going, sir.
Good morning, all.
49's adventures ran on BBC Radio from 1947 to 1953, 112 episodes in all, and it's still fondly remembered today, even though only two episodes are known to have survived. The creator of the series was Alan Strax. His career is recalled by his daughter, the broadcaster Susan Strax.
My daddy left school at... I think it was 14 or 15, and I think he became a milkman for a time. Then, very quickly, he got a job as a cub reporter on a local newspaper in Australia. He was born in Melbourne, Australia, and I think did very well, began to write, and then started writing for radio there and did a lot of broadcasting also. Met my mother, who was also involved in the same business, and they did quite well, very well in fact, in Australian radio, which was then of course commercial radio, long before we had it here. But they decided they wanted to be a small fish in a big pond rather than big fish in a small pond, and so they got on board one of those great big liners that they had then and came over to the home country, as it was considered. And they arrived with 2 and 6 between them, half a crown between them, had to very quickly get jobs. He went off selling things. He was selling everything from vacuum cleaners to space in the cinema. And eventually he started writing, selling stories to magazines and journals, and eventually to the BBC. He wrote several radio plays for the BBC, and in the late 40s, I think it was 47, he started writing PC 49.
Alan Stranks himself explained how he came to create 49 in an article published in 1952.
One morning, I went to New Scotland Yard to make some inquiries about a point of police routine. I was greeted by a sergeant on duty at the door.
So, you're one of the blokes who writes all this nonsense about special agents.
Well, you just listen to me, he barked. Don't you think it's about time some of you writers gave credit where credit is really due? Slightly puzzled, I asked him to explain what he meant.
It's about time you realise that almost 99% of the crimes committed in this country are solved by the keen observation and the devotion to duty of the ordinary bloke on the beat.
I've no doubt you're right, I replied lamely. But there's nothing very exciting about bashing a beat or taking the numbers of cars parked in prohibited areas. The public wants thrilling and colourful stories. His scornful laugh cut my explanation short.
All about private eyes in fancy silk dressing gowns puffing at cigarettes in long holders, eh? He snorted. Or amateur detectives who sit in their studies and solve a couple of murders between breakfast and lunch.
I began to realise this was a pretty accurate description of many characters in crime fiction.
Give the bobby a break, he went on. There's no one deserves it better.
As I walked along the Thames embankment 20 minutes later, I suddenly realised I was excitedly turning over in my mind an entirely new character. A common copper, a plain, everyday policeman. I realised there were many moments in a policeman's life which could be extremely exciting. As we sleep comfortably in our beds, I thought, these blue-clad bobbies wage a ceaseless war against the wrongdoer. And while their lives have little of the glamour of the special agent who is not bound by rules and regulations, there is always the possibility that around the next corner, or in the shadow of the dark doorway across the road, adventure with a capital A may be waiting to meet them. Before 24 hours had passed, the first PC-49 adventure was written.
The title probably derived from the popular Edwardian music hall song, PC-49, recorded by Harry Fay in 1910 and recalling the misadventures of a comic Cockney copper.
When I was out of work for Mrs. Snake, so much you see, I went down to the station to see if I'd make a tea. They dressed me in this uniform and then they said to me, you're PC-49. PC-49. Anyone can have this little job of mine.
The series was produced by Vernon Harris of the Variety Department.
Of course, the first problem I had was who played PC-49. Well, strangely enough, only 3 or 4 weeks, I think it was, before Alan had come in with this story, I'd done a radio version of a Cochrane musical at the Adelphi Theatre called Bless the Bride. And I was particularly struck by a young man who was playing the sort of second juvenile in it, who, instead of giving his Adelphi Theatre performance, which most of the rest of the cast did, came down and close to the mic and gave a much more intimate performance. And I thought at once, well, that's a bright young fella. So that was PC-49 fixed. Well, then I had to find his girlfriend, Joan Carr, she was called, his fiancée. And I went home one day and I said to my wife, I'm very bothered about finding this young woman for PC-49. And she said, well, look, I was listening to the radio this afternoon and I heard a play. And just before the play came on, the announcer said, we have to announce with great regret that Miss whoever it was has been taken ill and at the last minute is unable to appear in this play. This, I may say, was a live broadcast, not a recording. But fortunately, we've been able to find a young actress who stepped in at a moment's notice to play the part without any rehearsal. Her name is Joy Shelton. And my wife said she was wonderful. She can't have had time even, I shouldn't think, to look through the script. And she didn't fluff, she didn't falter, she gave a lovely performance. I said, that's the girl for me, I think. And the next day, I sent for Joy and she walked into the office and I knew at once I'd found my Joan Carr.
Norman Wright is a PC-49 expert and the editor of a collection of the PC-49 comic strips from The Eagle. He agrees about the importance of the casting.
I think it was very fortunate that Brian Reese was cast in the role of PC-49. He was able to bring a great touch of humour to the scripts, but at the same time had that hard edge when dealing with the many rough and unsavoury characters that he encountered in his division and his cases on the beat. Joy Shelton was a real feisty female. She took the knocks along with her fiancé, in a totally unofficial capacity, of course. She kept Archie on the straight and narrow. She would very often in the stories start to tell off his superiors for not recognising Archie's great potential and say, "Now you've got to give Archie a fair try. Archie would be good at this." And he would be saying, come on, Joan, out of the way, out of the way. Don't say that to the inspector.
I'm bound to say you did a jolly good job last night.
Thank you, sir.
In spite of the fact that in doing it, you chose to disregard my orders totally.
But, Inspector, if he hadn't gone to that flat, Tom Black would have got clean away.
Yes. There's no doubt, 49, that thanks to your observation...
And his deduction.
Quiet, Joan.
Well, yes, his observation plus his deduction...
To say nothing of his courage.
Quiet, Joan.
Miss Carr, who's supposed to be commending this man, you or me?
Well, you are, Inspector, but I must say you're not overdoing it.
Quiet, Joan.
Now then, Miss Carr, a little more respect, if you please.
All the same, she's quite right, Sergeant. It took a great deal of pluck to tackle that maniac.
No, more luck than pluck, sir.
Oh, well, luck. Pluck, deduction, or observation, whichever it was. It resulted in the capture of the gang who did that train job. By the way, 49, I've had a word with your inspector, and I fixed it for you to have a further 48 off. I think you've earned it.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you very much indeed. Isn't that wonderful, Joan?
Oh, marvellous. But we'll keep in close touch, Inspector.
Keep in touch? What for?
Well, you never know. Something important might crop up, and where would you be then?
Why, Joan.
Where would I be?
Yes, without Archie and
me. Oh, my Sunday helmet.
What? Get them out of here, right? Get them out before I...
Out you go, Miss Carr.
Just going, Sarge. Cheerio, Inspector. Come along, Archie, darling. Good morning, all.
It was a very happy show to work on, as Joy Shelton, the sole survivor of the regular cast, recalled in a 1982 interview.
PC-49 to me was sheer heaven. It was lovely. Vernon Harris was a smashing man to work for. Brian had a lovely quality. He wasn't an actory actor. He was a real person, lovely person. And I think it was the personalities that gelled. There was Leslie Perrins, Eric Phillips, the four of us every week. It was an atmosphere of people together, wanting to be together. To me, it was absolute magic. It was so much part of my life, and I miss them all terribly. Love to be able to see them all again.
Susan Stranks confirms this memory of the show.
As I remember it, the cast were a very happy mob, really like a family. And my parents were very social creatures, and they often used to give parties, drinks parties, and they all used to come round to visit. In general, they seemed to get on terribly, terribly well, and of course this went on for some 4 or 5 years. I think that's the value of having series that go on a long time, because people do form close relationships in the entertainment business, and it's one of the things that's special about it.
Archie's principal ambition was to prove himself as a detective. But whenever he got the chance, his eager beaver enthusiasm and tendency to blunder into dangerous situations exasperated his superior officers, Chief Inspector Wilson and Detective Sergeant Wright.
49, would you like to do a little job for us as a plainclothes aide?
Would I, Sarge? Just give me a chance.
All right. I'll fix it with the uniform inspector for you to go down to Euston, where you'll locate this ticket checker and get that young woman's address.
Oh, jolly good, Sarge.
And remember me, lad, that's all we're asking you to do. It's just a routine checkup.
Routine checkup, yes, sir.
So don't try out any of those highfalutin theories of yours.
Oh, me, Sarge? You ought to know me better than that.
We do, 49, we do. That's just the trouble.
Despite the comic banter, Archie had a shrewd brain and regularly applied the classic detection techniques of observation and deduction.
I've been adding up that little sum I was telling you about.
Not the answer yet?
I've got a hunch we might find it through the lady in the mink coat.
What's on your mind?
Diamonds.
What? Well, you mean the stones that were stolen from the mail van?
No, I mean the two little black diamonds that were left on the floor of that van.
By whom?
That's just what's troubling me. Listen, darling, the inside of this glove is filthy, and do you know what with?
No. Tell me.
Coal dust. Two small pieces of coal were found by the body of the ticket collector.
Oh, that's odd.
Now, no one on that train is under the slightest suspicion. At least none of the passengers.
So what?
There are two men on that train that Wilson and Wright haven't even dreamed of interviewing.
Who?
The engine driver and the fireman.
What?
It sounds crazy, I know, but...
Archie, are you trying to say that one of the engine crew crawled along the top of a train going at about 60 miles an hour?
It's possible. Especially if he had an accomplice in the train to open the window for him.
You mean the woman in the mink coat?
All I'm saying is that the woman in the mink coat dropped a man's glove, and that glove had obviously been worn by somebody whose hands were smothered in coal dust.
My Sunday bonnet. Well, you'd better tell Inspector Wilson your theory right away.
I'm going to tell him just as much as I think it's good for him to know.
49 also had a social conscience, regularly coming to the aid of ex-convicts or prisoners' families.
This Birdie Snipe was charged with pinching the Melton manuscript. But while he was out on bail awaiting his trial, he laid information that Fiddler Patchett had picked his pocket at the dog races. We picked up the Fiddler that night and found Birdie Snipe's wallet on him. So Fiddler went away to Parkhurst for a year's vacation.
When do we get to the fiddle? This fiddle?
We're coming to it now. You see, Mrs. Patchett...
The fiddler's wife?
That's her. Well, Mrs. Patchett has three kids. Fiddler left her a bit on the short side of what it takes to buy rations for three children, so I...
Bought Fiddler's violin from her, eh?
Only for a fiver, Joan. But you really needed the money. Fiddler can buy it back when he comes out, but in the meantime, I thought...
You thought what?
Well, I heard a wonderful record on the wireless. Max Carousel playing. So I thought, here's the chance to give Joan a big surprise.
And you certainly did that.
The mixture of comedy and thrills that Alan Stranks achieved in his scripts was one of the keys to the success of the series. Susan Stranks.
The humour that was generated, not only by the plots themselves, I mean, the case of the terrible twins, the case of the crying clown, they were all slightly humorous, quirky plots. And the relationship between Brian Reese, who was a bit of a buffoon, and Joyce Shelton, Joan, his girlfriend, who was perhaps even a little bit brighter and sometimes had the key to solving the plot. And the relationship also with his chief inspector and detective sergeant, Leslie Perrins and Eric Phillips, was also quite humorous. I mean, they tolerated his kind of slight stupidity and his rushing off in all directions. And it did make for a very good light comedy presentation of sometimes quite serious stuff.
Hello. That's funny. The door's open.
Shh, listen. It's a woman in that other room. She sounds as if...
Stay here. I'll go and see.
Not likely. I'm coming too. Oh, there she is.
Keep away, Joe. This is the work of a maniac.
I'll go and get some water. There must be a bathroom somewhere.
Now, take it easy, now. Take it easy. What the blazes?
Oh, gee, quick. In the bathroom. He tried to grab
me. Stand aside. Are you Tom Black?
I am Tom Black, all right. I heard you coming.
All right, Black, I'm a police officer.
A cop,
and
eh?
I'm taking you into custody for questioning in connection with
Nobody's
the...
Nobody's taking me anywhere till I finish the job I've got to do.
You've done enough already. You better go quietly.
Be careful, Archie.
Keep your distance, or I'll serve both of you like I served these two out there. Go! Oh! Got you, you swine.
Not yet, you haven't tried this, my side.
You haven't got a chance, copper. You just haven't got a chance.
Here's all I got left, chum.
Got him.
Alan Stranks also did extensive background research.
He was a stickler for research, so much so that he befriended a number of very high-up people at Scotland Yard, as it was then, before it was New Scotland Yard, and also quite a number of people in the underworld. And one particular friend I remember that he made, a lifelong friend, was a man called Wilf Dawes, who was chief superintendent of the Yard then. Flapsy Dawes, they called him, because he had these huge big ears, and he was a very, very tall guy. And once or twice, I remember, the newspapers carried reports of the fact that crimes had been committed which slightly mirrored plots which my father had put into 49. And I think eyebrows were raised, but because of his good contacts in Scotland Yard, I think it was clear that it wasn't anything to do with him.
The popularity of the series is evidenced by the way that catchphrases from the programme entered everyday speech. Norman Wright.
The catchphrase that everyone remembers from PC 49 is "Out you go, 49," which was usually said at the end of every adventure by Detective Sergeant Wright, and Archie would march off saying "Evening all" or "Afternoon all." That phrase was used for everything, from putting out the cat to sending off the children to school. Another catchphrase that was much used by Archie was, "Oh, my Sunday helmet!" And this was usually when he suddenly got a flash of inspiration or realised who the villain was or what he'd been missing.
The series became particularly popular with children.
Well, it started off as a series for adults. It was originally broadcast in the late evening on 9:30, but the scripts were very well written and they could be appreciated, I think, by people of almost any age. The BBC realised that, like Dick Barton, they'd got something that appealed to all ages, and so they started to repeat the programme in the early evening for children.
adults and children used to listen together, or if they were younger children, of course, they would go to bed with their radios under the bedclothes and listen. I was very lucky because I went to a boarding school for a while during the latter half of PC49's success, and I was allowed to listen to it at school, which was unprecedented, so I was popular because everybody else could listen to PC49 as well.
This popularity with children led to the newly launched Eagle Comic hiring Stranks to script a comic strip of PC49, which ran from 1950 to 1957.
PC49 began in the very first issue of the Eagle, and in the early days of that paper, when the strip was being drawn by an artist named Strom Gould, it followed very closely the radio stories. We had Joan Carr there and all the other characters from the radio. But after a couple of years, there was a change. A new artist was brought in, and this was John Worsley, who was had been a war artist. His style was superb. He started to make PC49 look like Brian Rees, but there were a number of changes, and the main change was that Joan was out. Comics at that time thought there had to be some juvenile characters for the readers to identify with, and Stranks introduced the Boys Club. These were a group of youngsters whom PC49 trained in his spare time in boxing and so on. He even took them away on a holiday with him, so the poor copper got very little in the way of a break.
There were also two films.
In October 1949, Hammer Films released the first of their two PC49 films, The Adventures of PC49. Unfortunately, Brian Rees was busy with stage work at that time, so they cast Hugh Latimer as PC49 and Patricia Cutts as Joan. And for some reason, they changed the division, which in all the stories and the Eagle had been Q Division, to S Division. The film was quite a violent film, as I suppose were many of the Hammer films at that time.
I joined the force because it seemed the only legitimate way to get action in peacetime. But what a hope. Nothing was going to happen on this beat. Nothing to earn a man his stripes or break the monotony. And then...
Last night was the sixth consecutive truck robbery in this division in less than a month.
Yes, sir.
Now look here, 49. I've no doubt you did your duty to the best of your ability. This statement, you know, of yours gets us nowhere. Isn't there something you've forgotten?
It's all in that statement, Inspector.
Yes. Attempted murder of Cullen's watchman and not a clue.
Come straight from the hospital, sir. Night watchman just died.
You managed to get a statement?
I'm afraid he never regained consciousness.
They're drawing blanks all along the line, eh? All right, 49, you can go.
Yes, sir. Excuse me, sir.
Yes?
Well, you know I've applied for duty as a plainclothes aide.
Well, what about it?
Well, I was wondering, sir, if there was any hope of mine being given a chance on this case.
Unfortunately, although Latimer was good, he was unable to combine the humour and action in quite the same way as Rees had on the radio. And Patricia Cutts was just a little too soft as Joan Carr. Fortunately, the second film, A Case for PC49, which came a few years later in 1951, again scripted by Stranks and Harris, it was still a tough picture, but there was much more of the radio humour, owing to Brian Rees and Joy Shelton taking the leading roles.
If you ask me, Sarge, Wilson and Wright don't know a clue who my Aunt Fanny. Three times I've been turned down for plainclothes jobs. And you know who's behind it, don't you? Detective Sergeant Blinkin' Wright. That old flatfoot. The next time I see him, I'm going to say... Hello, Sarge. Just going on duty, Sarge. Good morning, all.
Bye.
Oh, sorry. Oh.
Well?
Miss Della Dayton.
Oh, so you know me.
Yes, please. I mean...
49?
Yes, Sarge. Just going on duty, Sarge.
Well, do that bottom button up to start with.
Oh, yes, Sarge.
Alan Stranks had undertaken a punishing work schedule. For alongside PC49, he was also scripting, during 1951-52, another radio police series, Flint of the Flying Squad, starring Bruce Seaton, as well as his Eagle comic strips and four PC49 annuals. In addition, he was a busy and successful song lyricist, one of whose songs, All, won the British Heat of the Eurovision Song Contest. His daughter Susan Stranks recalls his work routine.
He was a great night bird. He always worked to deadlines. He always sharpened his pencils first. I can see him. He used to have hundreds of sharpened pencils and lots of paper. And he used to doodle a lot. putting off the dreadful time when he actually commit to a plot. And he used to go out, we used to live in Dolphin Square on the river, and that has an internal garden, and I used to look out of the window and see my father with his, always with his hands behind his back and a cigarette in them, walking around, working out the next plot. And he was very brilliant at plots, but he always used to leave things rather late. And it's interesting to mention that he was a chain smoker. He was a very heavy smoker, and he only used to smoke half of each cigarette. And on occasion, he used to decide to cut down on smoking, and he used to do this by rolling his own. So when he had a deadline, he used to say to me, "Susie, will you roll me 50 cigarettes? And hand me one of these newfangled machines with rollers." And I used to sit down and roll him 50 cigarettes so that he could get on with his writing. And this was his idea of giving up cigarettes.
Alan Stranks died while on holiday in Spain in 1959, still only in his 50s. PC 49 is his lasting legacy. 49 looked back to the musical comedy policeman of the interwar years, but also forward to the next great development in the dramatic representation of the police, social realism.
Good evening, all. All right, son, I'm sorry. On you go. You can't play the D, you know.
Good evening, Constable.
Good evening, madam.
Can you tell me the way to Dock Green Lane, please?
Yes, madam. Straight down the road, first right, left by the garage, and you're there.
Dixon of Dock Green. In January 1950, 3 years after PC 49 made his radio debut, a film was released which permanently changed the popular image of the police. It was The Blue Lamp, whose central figure, PC George Dixon, was gunned down by hoodlum Dirk Bogarde halfway through the film. In 1955, Dixon was revived by his creator Ted Willis on television, and Jack Warner returned to his film role and was to play it continuously until 1976, 434 episodes in all. The series confirmed the transformation of the cultural image of the police. But we should not forget that it was PC 49 who paved the way for the revaluation of the ordinary copper patrolling his beat.
That concludes The Case of the Black Diamonds, another incident in this series of adventures of PC 49 by Alan Stranks.